Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're looking at a really challenging stack of sources. We have policy memos, intelligence reports, legal analyses.
A lot to get through.
A lot to get through. And it's all about one of the most, well, significant and controversial shifts in U.S. foreign policy in years. We're setting our focus today on the azure depths of the Southern Caribbean.
Yeah, that's right. And our mission really is to give you a shortcut to understanding what's being called Operation Southern Spear.
And this wasn't just some tactical change, was it?
Oh, not at all. It fundamentally replaced over 100 years of legal precedent.
Yeah.
Where the old approach to drug smuggling was always to arrest smugglers, bring them to trial, a new directive was executed. It all started on September 2, 2025.
And the new directive?
Yeah.
I mean, it's chillingly simple, isn't it? Kill smugglers at sea instead of arresting them.
That's the policy. And it immediately, I mean, instantly ignited this firestorm of ethical and legal controversy.
Yeah. Critics in Washington, D.C. are basically arguing the U.S. just declared open season on its own legal framework.
So to really get this, we need to understand the historical bedrock that they just demolished before we look at what happened on that day.
Okay, so let's break that down.
Right. Maritime drug interdiction used to be a very stable field of law. The U.S. made its first official opium seizure at sea way back in 1886.
Wow. Okay.
And since then, this kind of activity has always been designated as a policing act. It fell under law enforcement rules.
And that designation, that's the key differentiator for you, the listener, right? Mm. Because when we think law enforcement at sea, we're thinking U.S. Coast Guard.
Exactly.
They operate under rules built for due process. You know, they fire warning shots, they board the vessel, they gather physical evidence.
Process the crime scene.
And then the suspects get their day in court.
Yeah.
That was the established procedure for over a century.
It was a system built entirely on evidence and judicial review. But the sources we have show that the Trump administration, specifically under President Trump and Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth, they decided to rewrite those rules completely.
For Operation Southern Spear?
For Operation Southern Spear. They introduced a doctrine that just fundamentally reframes the threat.
So how do you get from a policing act to a military strike? I mean, what's the legal or the conceptual jump they're making there?
They argue that the sheer volume of drugs coming in and the nature of the organizations smuggling them is functionally the same as an armed invasion of the United States.
An armed invasion.
And if it's an armed invasion, well, that justifies a total military response under the laws of armed conflict, not a civilian law enforcement response.
Wait, hold on. So the U.S. is arguing that a fiberglass fishing boat carrying drugs is an armed invasion that justifies a military strike. How do you even sell that to allies?
You sell it by redefining the target. The sources we have link this specific boat, the one targeted on September 2nd, to the Tren de Aragua.
A very large Venezuelan gang.
A very large gang that the U.S. government had just recently designated as a foreign terrorist organization.
Ah, and there it is. Yeah. That designation is the pivot point, isn't it?
It's everything.
Because once you call the organization a terrorist entity, you can then classify the crew members, you know, regardless of their actual role, as narco-terrorists.
Exactly. And this is where we can sort of connect the dots back to post-9/11 legal thinking. By calling them narco-terrorists or unlawful enemy combatants, the Pentagon is basically repurposing the same legal mechanism they used for detainees at Guantanamo Bay.
So they're not just criminals anymore. They're not entitled to due process.
No, the argument is that they're a continuous, unprivileged threat to U.S. national security. And that transforms the Coast Guard's job into the military's job. It's a shift from a police action to, well, essentially a declaration of war on a cocaine delivery boat.
And that shift means Hellfire missile attacks have now replaced the due process of law. Let's get into the operational details of that first strike on September 2nd, 2025.
The initial action, it was described as a precision attack. It was carried out by air assets. A guided missile struck the vessel right in the center.
And the goal wasn't just to stop it.
No, the tactical goal was total destruction. Break the hull, detonate the boat's fuel stores, make sure there's no escape, no evidence to recover.
And the outcome was,
yeah.
I mean, just catastrophic. The explosion on a fiberglass boat, it just went up, smashed. To smithereens is the phrase used in the sources.
9 of the 11 men on board were killed instantly. The boat capsized. Wreckage, bales of cocaine just scattered everywhere in remote international waters.
But the operation, which was, you know, designed for this maximum lethal efficiency, It immediately went off script.
It did. The sources confirmed that surveillance drones were streaming live video back to command centers in Florida.
And the Pentagon.
And the Pentagon. And they see a massive unforeseen problem.
Two survivors.
Two survivors.
Just two men. The footage shows them shirtless, probably injured, definitely unarmed. They'd managed to grab onto a piece of the wreckage, a floating section of the keel.
Everyone else is dead, their boat is gone, and they are adrift in the middle of nowhere. I mean, you can see it on the video. They are absolutely defenseless, helpless.
Let's just sit with that image for a second. Because that sight, those two men on that piece of debris, it immediately elevates this whole thing from a military strike to a profound legal and ethical crisis.
It really does.
Yeah.
This is the very definition of being hors de combat.
Can you just unpack that term for us, hors de combat?
Yeah.
Because it is absolutely central to what happens next.
Sure. It's French for out of the fight. And it is a foundational concept in the Geneva Conventions, in the laws of armed conflict.
So it protects soldiers who can't fight anymore.
Right. It grants protection to anyone who's removed from the fight, whether they're injured, captured, or, and this is critical here, shipwrecked.
Okay.
The whole principle is that once a person is no longer a threat, they stop being a target. The duty shifts immediately. You go from engaging them to rescuing them.
So killing a person who is hors de combat is?
It's a core violation of international humanitarian law. It's one of the clearest lines there is.
So the law is crystal clear.
Okay.
They have to be rescued, not targeted. But what did the U.S. command structure do?
Despite that clear precedent, the operation commander, a Navy admiral named Frank Mitch Bradley, made a calculated decision. He ordered a second strike.
A second strike.
Yep.
On the floating debris.
On the debris where those two men were sheltering.
So that action needs a justification.
Mm.
And the sources show that the entire fate of international law in this moment hinged on how you interpreted the actions of those survivors.
Right. You've got this live surveillance footage being piped straight to the Pentagon, and Washington splits instantly over what they're seeing.
Exactly. On one side, you have human rights observers, Democratic lawmakers. They look at the drone video and they say the two survivors are clearly waving their hands.
And they see that as a sign of distress, right?
Unambiguous signs of distress.
Yeah.
Or surrender, a call for rescue. I mean, they had no weapons, no radio, no way to move. They were just passive victims of a shipwreck.
But the government and its defenders, you know, powerful people like Senator Tom Cotton, military officials, they offered a radically different take on the exact same footage.
What was their interpretation?
They claimed the hand waving wasn't surrender at all. It was an act of continued hostility.
Oh.
They argued the men were signaling to nearby cartel boats, trying to salvage the huge amount of illicit cargo that was now floating on the water. Therefore, they were still fighting.
So if you're waving for help, you might actually be signaling your cartel buddies, and that means you are still a valid military target.
That was the official justification. And beyond that, Admiral Bradley reportedly assessed that the floating debris itself, whether the men were on it or not, might still have cocaine on it, so it was a valid military target.
That is a chilling calculus.
Yeah.
But regardless of how you interpret a hand wave, the outcome was predetermined.
It was. On the admiral's orders, a second series of munitions struck that debris field.
And the two survivors were killed instantly.
And that event, that second strike, that's the grim milestone. What's fascinating here is the immediate and really blunt legal fallout.
Mm-hmm.
Brian Finucane, a former State Department lawyer, he gave one of the most blistering condemnations in the sources.
What was his specific assessment?
He was completely uncompromising. He said, quote, "The term we have for a premeditated act like that outside of armed conflict is murder."
Murder.
He went on to say that under settled international law, quote, "it is patently illegal to kill a person who has suffered a shipwreck." He's saying this isn't a gray area. It's a foundational violation.
It's a huge claim, especially from a former government lawyer. So if the action is being described as murder, how on earth does the Pentagon push back?
Their entire defense hangs on that initial designation we talked about, narco-terrorists.
Right.
They just insist that by classifying the crew as unlawful enemy combatants, they were operating outside the protection of the Geneva Conventions. They argue these men posed a continuous threat to national security, even while floating on a piece of wood.
And Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth, he just reinforced this publicly, didn't he? He removed any shred of ambiguity.
He absolutely doubled down. He stated unequivocally, "If you bring drugs to this country in a boat, we will find you and we will sink you."
So that rhetoric just confirms the shift. Due process is gone. It's replaced entirely by the severity of the threat assessment, whether you're actually fighting or not.
And this wasn't just a one-off you know, a bad call by Admiral Bradley, this set the precedent for Operation Southern Spear going forward.
So it kept happening.
Oh, yes. The sources reveal the sheer scale of this policy. In the months right after that first strike on September 2nd, U.S. forces carried out over 20 other similar attacks.
20.
All in the Southern Caribbean. And these attacks resulted in the documented deaths of more than 80 people.
80 people. Killed without arrest, without a trial. And the problem with transparency here just makes the legal crisis even worse.
Right. The Pentagon says all 80 were narco-terrorists. But the families of the dead from places like Colombia, Venezuela, Trinidad, and Tobago, they tell a different story.
What do they say?
They argue these were poor fishermen or temporary workers, people forced into smuggling who had no real connection to a geopolitical war. They were economically vulnerable, not ideological warriors.
And crucially, the whole system was designed for zero accountability. The names of the dead, not officially released. No bodies recovered for a post-mortem.
And the only evidence, the boat, the electronics, the cargo, it all sank to the bottom of the Caribbean. It creates a perfect legal dead end.
You destroy the evidence, you kill all the witnesses, it gives the military a clean slate, makes any kind of third-party investigation almost impossible.
It's a policy of total lethal interdiction with opacity built right in.
And this lack of transparency, this extreme lethality, it led to investigations in Washington, didn't it? Lawmakers wanted to know if an explicit kill-them-all order came from the top.
They were looking for the smoking gun. Did Secretary Hegseth give the order? Admiral Bradley testified he received no explicit order, written or verbal, to kill the survivors. But his decision to order that second strike anyway against defenseless men, it reveals the kind of culture, and that's a quote, the kind of culture that Operation Southern Spear created.
It shows that even without a direct command, the whole operational environment, the rhetoric from the top, the reclassification from criminal to enemy combatant, it created an implicit understanding.
An understanding that total elimination was the goal, even for those who are hors de combat.
That's maybe the most difficult takeaway here, that September 2, 2025, it really does serve as this grim milestone in American foreign policy. The day a U.S. command structure chose to allegedly ignore the most basic parts of the Geneva Conventions.
And kill defenseless survivors in international waters.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener? I mean, the horrific details of that second strike, they raise these huge, uncomfortable questions that go way beyond just drug policy.
Right. Like, can a government just unilaterally declare that criminals are now soldiers in a war?
And if they can do that, do they then have the right to kill them without due process? Especially when they are so clearly removed from the fight, so defenseless.
The ultimate question for everyone, really, is what is the Geneva Convention worth? What is it worth if it can just be ignored or reinterpreted on the fly by one nation's command structure to justify eliminating survivors just to complete a mission?
There are congressional hearings, high-level lawsuits are pending to address these very issues. But the sources, they conclude by posing this massive challenge.
Yeah, they do. While the legal answers on paper seem pretty clear, you know, that killing or to combat survivors is a violation, the central tension is whether the current U.S. administration will even share that legal interpretation.
One unnamed official is quoted in the material as saying, the administration has absolutely no respect for national or international rules. And that's the tension that really defines the future of this kind of maritime warfare.